Welcome to a new sermon series. If I haven't met you, my name is Pastor Mike Lotzer. If you're joining us online, so glad you're with us. The series is called Skeptics Welcome. As opposed to skeptics manipulated, skeptics excluded, skeptics not thought highly of, skeptics not really put up with, no, we actually like you skeptics. And our church family is made up of a fair amount of skeptics. We even have people who are followers of Jesus who would admit that they've got a skeptical streak that runs pretty wide through their heart. They've got questions, and we want to be a church where people who are agnostic, that just means they don't know what to believe. There might be a God, but they're not sure. People who are atheists, people who are pretty convinced there's no God, and people who are fully committed followers of Jesus can come here on Sunday mornings and in our gatherings and outreach, and we can start to do life together. Skeptics are not an abstract group for me. I would consider myself a skeptic. You see, I had a really hard time picking a college major. Like, I picked 10 of them. I just kept going through them, and I couldn't figure out what I wanted to do. And I kept having this sense that I needed to go into ministry. But that's not really cool when you're going to a state school, right? No one else is going into ministry. They're going to business or whatever. And I kept wondering, you know, if I'm going to do this, if I'm going to go dedicate my life to tell people about Jesus because I'm so convinced, I need to be even more convinced. And so I ended up studying psychology and comparative world religions. And that was an incredible phase in my life because I had the opportunity to ask every question. You see, I didn't go to a Christian university. Most of my professors didn't share my faith. And so not only was I allowed to ask questions, I was demanded to give replies. And I was forced to really just go into all these areas that, honestly, a lot of Christians just stay out of because they just don't want anything to crop up, anything like a doubt in their faith. Here's what I learned. When we embrace the questions and we invite God into that, we don't get a weaker faith. We get a stronger faith. That was my experience. And so that's what we'll be doing in the series. Each week we'll take kind of a heavy topic. You could call it a reasonable objection. Somebody who is not a follower of Jesus would say, what about this? Because I've heard that I can't really believe or I can't follow if I believe this or if I have questions or doubts about this. Could you clarify that for me? We're going to attempt to do that. And just at the onset, I'm going to say one thing. I'm not an expert on anything. I don't have all the answers. Any more than you have all the answers. We're figuring this out together. So if you're interested on this journey, it'll be 5 weeks. Today, we are talking about science. Science. And we're going to start with a psalm, like all good scientists do. Psalm 19, 1 through 6. The heavens proclaim the glory of God. The skies display his craftsmanship. Day after day, they continue to speak. Night after night, they make him known. They speak without a sound or a word. Their voice is never heard, yet their message has gone throughout the earth and their words to all the world. God has made a home in the heavens for the sun. It bursts forth like a radiant bridegroom after his wedding. It rejoices like a great athlete eager to run the race. The sun rises at one end of the heavens and follows its course to the other end. Nothing can hide from its heat. If you're taking notes, folks, in light of this psalm, I want to make a statement. Accurate theology, belief in God, and accurate science, they both require one key ingredient. What is it? It's humility. Accurate theology, accurate science, good theology, good science, they require one common ingredient among others, surely, but one for sure, it's humility. Why do I think that? Well, I remember taking a few courses in astronomy and starting to get a grasp of how big our universe is, and I remember feeling very small. And I remember being convicted in that moment and thinking, when I pray to God, I kind of give God a to-do list. I'm like his personal consultant, like, God, if you would do this, 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 and this order, that would be great. And then I was just kind of wrecked by the scale of the universe that God created. And I'd like us to start this conversation on science and faith. Are they mutually exclusive? Can they coexist? Do they work well together? Do they not play well together? I'd like to start that conversation with a golf ball, okay? It's a Pro V1. Any golfers? Raise your hand. Yep, that's an expensive ball. Thank you, Dave Keegan. He got it for me. I don't hit Pro V1s because my drives go in the woods, so, you know. little cheaper golf ball, but this is a really well-made golf ball. And here's, for illustration's sake, what we're going to say. What if the earth was the size of a golf ball? Some of you have heard this illustration. Imagine the earth is the size of a golf ball. How big do you think the sun would be in relationship to this little golf ball that's earth? It would be 15 feet in diameter. That's a little bigger than our screen up there. I mean, look at that. It's bigger than the screen, and here's earth. And that's the sun. And that's the largest star in our immediate region in outer space. And that is the thing that gives us life in a very scientific sense of the word. It gives us warmth. We would be in outer cold darkness without that big burning star that was set just perfectly, just the perfect distance away from our particular little golf ball, so that as we orbit around that, we can have life. And we know from living here in Minnesota that there are better places to live on the golf ball than others with relationship to that big 15-foot diameter sun, but we're doing okay this time of year. Okay, so if the earth was the size of a golf ball, the sun would be 15 feet in diameter. 960,000 earths could fit into our sun. So 960,000 golf balls. That's enough golf balls to fill an entire school bus. So there's a lot more sun than there is earth. It makes me feel very tiny because the earth feels very big to me. But let's keep going. 430 light years away. Do you know what a light year is? Light traveling for a full year is a light year. Think of how fast light moves across a room or the earth. If you let that light just race on for a full year, it would take 430 years of light racing to get to this massive star called Betelgeuse. I think it's German, but I've also heard it pronounced Betelgeuse. I don't think that's right, but we're going to call it Betelgeuse. If Earth was a golf ball, this star, this Betelgeuse star, would be 6 Empire State Buildings tall. You could go to New York and you could take your little golf ball and pretend in your mind this is Earth, and you'd set it at the little base of the Empire State Building, and you'd look up at that and you'd say, now imagine putting 5 more right on top of it. Wow. Does that make you feel a little small? 262 trillion Earths could fit in that star in Betelgeuse. That is enough golf balls to fill U.S. Bank Stadium approximately 2,500 times. Canis Major. That is the big brother to Betelgeuse. He's even bigger. It's the biggest star that we're aware of with our technology. And that star would be as tall as Mount Everest if the Earth was a golf ball. So if little Earth golf ball is next to Mount Everest, you look all the way up. How many Earths could fit in this star? That would be enough golf ball-sized Earth to cover Texas, the entire state of Texas, in golf balls 22 inches deep. That's a lot of golf balls. And we lived on this tiny little privileged golf ball that is orbiting our relatively small star that we call the sun, that is perfectly placed away from us. Now that just humbles you, doesn't it? Whether you're a theologian or a scientist, doesn't that just check your ego at the door a little bit? And if it doesn't, consider the fact that even as we're having this conversation and trying to figure out, is science and faith compatible or are they at odds with each other, we're actually not sitting still. You feel like you're sitting still, but you're moving at 167,000 miles per hour as you orbit around the sun. That's how fast we're moving right now. If you don't have scale or scope for that, you did watch the Masters, I'm sure, at least the last two holes, and you did see Tiger Woods hit most of his epic drives to win the Masters in that great comeback. And if you did Google it, you would find out the fastest drive he had in that round was 148 miles per hour. We're sitting having a debate and a conversation on a golf ball that isn't going 148 miles an hour, but 167,000 miles an hour. And we're perfectly orbiting this big ball of heat that gives us life only because it was perfectly placed away from our little golf ball that orbits around. Now, some of you are thinking, why did I come to church if he's just going to talk about golf balls and astronomy? Here's what I'm getting at. Like all controversial subjects, The people who cut through the chaos to the truth are the people who are humble enough to admit what they don't know, who are humble enough to say, I haven't arrived yet. I don't have all the answers. And whoever made all this, whatever is responsible for all this, it makes me feel very small, and it kind of puts me in my place. And so I'm here to learn and not to teach. And that's the spirit by which we move into this series and to our next point. Accurate theology does require humility, so does accurate science. And here's what I want to say. Science and faith, they're just not at odds. They're not. You've heard that they are, that they always are, that you can't be a person of science and a person of faith. I think you're wrong. Humbly, I think you're wrong. I think rather people are quite limited. People are quite limited, including myself. I think that we don't see the full picture. I think that we're doing our best to describe how God has ordained and set up and established all things. And at best, we're describing. We're rarely prescribing. And if we look back in our own human history, it should humble us enough to say that maybe it's not science and faith that are at odds. Maybe it's our limited little perspective. Do you know that just a few centuries ago on this spinning little golf ball, if you got sick and you went to the best doctor, you like sold the farm to go to the best doctor, do you know what they would do to you? They'd cut you open and let you bleed for a few hours. It was called bloodletting, and it was the best technology, the best scientific method of the age to get rid of the anxious humors that lived in your blood that science had identified for sure lived inside your bloodstream. Ancient gladiators received better medicine than some people who fought in our Revolutionary War. That's how far science had regressed in the field of medicine itself in a few short centuries. In other words, I'm not picking on ancient doctors. What I am saying is that we are so sure that we have scientifically proven this and gotten this right, but there are myriads of examples, just go Google them, of just embarrassing faux pas where we said, oh, maybe that wasn't true. Maybe that wasn't right. Maybe our confidence was a bit misplaced. Maybe we didn't really understand. Maybe there's something called germ theory, and there's these little invisible things, and if you touch hands and you sneeze on each other's face, that's going to have a cause and effect. You know that came relatively late in our history, in our human history? Science and faith are not at odds. Do you know who invented the scientific method of inquiry? I can remember this one because I love his last name. Sir Francis Bacon is his name. Sir Francis Bacon. And he was an Anglican believer. He was a follower of Jesus Christ, and he was the father of modern science, the father of the modern scientific method. He was the one that laid out the process by which we do good science, where we observe and we study and we develop a hypothesis and we test that hypothesis. And then we are intellectually honest enough and humble enough to look at the results and not manipulate them and actually say, like, it's either proving my idea was right, my proposition of how stuff works is accurate, or that it's off, it's not right. And this is the guy that started scientific methodology, and he's a follower of Jesus Christ. Is that a surprise to you? That very same man is quoted in Old English, so I'm going to translate it in modern English for you, but he says essentially this: if a man or a woman dabbles in philosophy and science, they will surely become an atheist. But if they go deep into philosophy and science and commit their mind to consider the deeper realities of the universe and really study and really think and use my scientific method, I see no other possibility than them coming to believe, to becoming a theist, to see God behind it all. I think we live in a soundbite age. I think we live in a lazy age where we don't think deeply about much for very long, ever. And as a result, we are prone to very simplistic arguments. Oh, I don't know, like, you can't follow Jesus if you are scientific. Really? Why can't you? Boop, a YouTube video about a cat. Let's stop thinking about that, right? That's how it goes. We have 8-minute attention spans. And so we're prone to these really life-shaping philosophical sound bites that could be true, but maybe they're not. And what we're saying here is science and faith, they're not at odds. Now, of course, there's tensions and there's implications and there's ethics involved, and all that requires deep thinking. But to just say that science and faith are at odds, which a majority of Americans now believe, according to a Pew study, that's nonsense, guys. It just is. I'd like us to look at Proverbs 8. It's really kind of a unique, well, let's first look at Francis Collins. Anyone know Francis Collins? Looks like the life of the party, right? No, he's a great guy. He was appointed to a scientific post by the President of the United States, Obama, and Trump likes him. You know, if Trump and Obama like you, wow, right? The God of the Bible is also the God of the genome. God can be found in the cathedral or in the laboratory. This is a believer, a follower of Jesus Christ, who is in the upper echelons of elite scientists in our generation. Do you know they exist? Or have you bought into the soundbite that, no, you can't be smart, you can't be a molecular biologist, you can't be a physicist, you can't understand the deep things of scientific reality and astronomy and follow Jesus? Well, Francis Collins says you can. And he says that God has been revealed to him in the sermon and in the scriptures and in the microscope and in the scientific methodology. All of the universe is shaped by God's wisdom. That is something that Proverbs 8 says. That is something that believers believe. That is something that scientific mind Francis Collins believes. The question is, if you're a skeptic or a believer, do you believe that? That's an interesting question. This is Proverbs 8 is a unique genre. It's in the wisdom literature, and what we're about to read is self-referential in that you're speaking kind of in the first person, and wisdom is being personified in the book of Proverbs in chapter 8 of the book of Proverbs. And so when it says I, it's wisdom talking, okay? So now that you know that background, let's jump into Proverbs 8. The Lord formed me, I put in parentheses wisdom, from the beginning, in yellow, from the beginning. So not like lately, but in the beginning. Before, notice before he created anything, before anything was created, any golf balls, any stars big enough to eclipse every golf ball, before he created anything else, I, wisdom, was appointed in ages past. At the very first, before the earth began, I was born before the oceans were created, before the springs bubbled forth their waters, before the mountains were formed, before the hills, I was born. Before he had made the earth and fields and the first handfuls of soil, I was there when he established the heavens, when he drew the horizon on the oceans. Now, there's a little more to it, but let's just time out for a second. Why would God include in what we believe to be inspired scripture this type of literature? I mean, think about ancient people reading this. Why would that be relevant to them? Okay, so wisdom was there from the beginning? So God was wise and skillful and like a craftsman and intentional in his design? This was not a debate raging in the ancient world. It was just largely agreed upon. But doesn't this feel like it was meant for 2019? It just lands on us here, and it's like God is saying, hey, before anything happened, wisdom preceded it. Not chaos, not oops, intentionality, craftsmanship. Wow. When I read this, I just kind of get the chills. Like, it's like ancient literature is reaching out, and it has my number. I was there when he set the clouds above, when he established springs deep in the earth. I was there, says wisdom, when he set the limits of the sea. You ever consider that without limits in the natural order, like the oceans, this would be a very bad place, as evidenced by the very, very bad movie, Waterworld. Remember? I was there when he set the limits of the seas so they would not spread beyond their boundaries, and when he marked off the earth's foundations. I was the architect by his side. What a word picture. God creates And there's this like really competent architect named Wisdom walking by his side saying, maybe you want to consider that angle. Maybe that limit should be a little to the left. Maybe we could make this one higher. Let's reinforce this boundary line. I was his constant delight, rejoicing always in his presence, and how happy I was with the world he created, how I rejoiced with the human family. That's a cool ending. Wisdom is saying, like, I was part of the building project, and when it was done, I was like, we nailed it. Awesome, God. Now, anytime a virtue is personified in ancient literature, it doesn't actually mean it's a person named Wisdom. It's an artistic and beautiful way to say that God knew what he was doing when he put all this stuff together, that he made it, that he was wise in it. He didn't slap this together. He put it together like a true craftsman. Some of you are craftsmen. And you know a craftsman is good when you go in their house, in their house, right? Because if you're like a carpenter or a craftsman, you're going to get those miter joints perfect in your house, right? You're going to get that trim perfect. You're going to get that open concept design just perfect. Not that you don't get it perfect in other people's house, but you really don't want to have to stare at a mistake while in your bathrobe, right? God is presented as a craftsman that has ownership over this golf ball, that wants to make it ideal and perfect. And Wisdom is celebrating here. The claim is that when all that we see and experience, touch, taste, feel, sense, observe, take in the natural parks around us at the micro and the macro level, when we observe all that and our senses light up, we can trust that a God actually designed that with wisdom in mind for our good. Now, to be sure, there are tsunamis. There are broken weather patterns. There is pollution. There's all sorts of things that are wrong with the golf ball right now. And the explanation from a theist point of view, from a follower of Christ, is that ever since the cancer of sin entered into the system of the earth and the human race, nothing works quite like it should. It's a little off kilter. It's a little broken, and brokenness pops up here and there and here. But it's kind of like this gift that was given to me. I preach at a nursing home Fridays at 11, and this sweet old man named Roy, who is just a woodworking genius, gave me a little basket for my daughter for Easter. And he must have taken 100 hours on making this basket. It was the thinnest little cut pieces of cedar that he laced in to look like it was a weaved basket, but it's actually bent pieces of wood that he had to soak and bend and move. Now, here's an embarrassing admission. He gives it to me after I do the service, and he said, this is for your little girl Adeline, who you talk about sometimes in here, and I think she'd love it as an Easter present. I said, oh, thank you, Roy. Man, what craftsmanship. Look at the bow. You even made the bow out of wood. How do you even do that? This is so cool. And as I'm walking to join him for coffee, it catches the corner of my jeans, and I drop the basket, and it breaks in four pieces. I had the basket for like 10 seconds until I completely shattered the basket. It was an interesting moment, right? They're all in walkers, and they all kind of turn around and look at me, and there's this moment like, oh! And Roy was super gracious, and I'm picking up the pieces of the basket. And he almost, like, I was so sad. It's like, he got a little, like, teary. And I said, I'm so sorry, Roy. I really loved this basket. And he said, it's okay. For 2 weeks, he worked on restoring the basket. He glued all the joints together. And so I still have the basket today. And it's beautiful. But now, if you look at the basket, you can actually see where I broke it. And he kind of hastily repaired it. And that's what we have going on earth right now. We busted it. God has repaired it enough to get us by until he comes back and makes it all new, better, stronger than ever before. He's going to renew the whole earth. That's the claim. But we live in the here and now and the not yet. And so the basket has some serious fault lines on it. And yet we can't look at that basket and, being the ones who broke it, say, there wasn't wisdom in this. Nobody tried hard on this. Look it. The handle was cracked off. No, he tried really hard. It was actually perfect. I broke that. Okay. I want to just acknowledge the tension in the room that exists on some issues here. And just a forewarning, I'm probably going to offend some people on the right and the left. And if I don't, I don't think I've done a good job. A lot of us believers come to the table and we have an issue. For many of us, it's creationism. It's six-day literal creation. And if that seems to be the straightforward reading of the text in the Genesis creation account, and if that's not how it happened, and if the earth is not somewhere between 6,000 and 10,000 years old, then la, 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 and if any preacher preaches anything but that, they must be heretical. They must not believe the Bible is inerrant and full of authority and able to change life, and that's our deal. Others, it's all about gender science, and they're so uncomfortable with some of the claims from different scientists and all that, and if a preacher even brings up that, they're just like going to lose their mind, you know? For others, it's the really emotionally loaded debate between chiropractic science and physical therapy, right? You know, we all got the back issues, and those chiropractors, they're magicians. No, it's the surgery that matters. You know, not really. That's not a big hot topic. But you get the idea. For some of us, it's global warming. It's like, no, that doesn't exist. Yes, it does. How could it not? And we let these issues become pivotal. Become a hinge on which our whole faith, our whole worldview turns. And here's what I want to challenge you with. We need to realize that we are in an age where there is a lot of confusion around a lot of things. Do you know, for example, that about 20% of Americans, according to a recent Pew study in 2019, believe that humans always existed in human form? And that when Genesis says 6 days, that literally means 6 days, and the earth is about 6,000 to 10,000 years old. That's about 20% of the American population. That's not a small group. Do you know that roughly half of the remainder believe in what is called non-theistic evolution or scientific evolution? It's the belief that there was a Big Bang, there was a bunch of accidental oops, nobody knows how it happened, events that led to the evolution of microorganisms into larger organisms, into Homo sapiens, into us. And there is no God behind that. And we don't know why it happened. And we don't even need to know why it happened. It's just cold science, clearly. And when our sun goes out, the golf ball will go dark. And everything you have ever said, everyone you have ever loved, everything you have ever done, will be forgotten, won't matter, will be lost in the cold darkness of space. That's a big chunk of the American population that believe that. And then there's about a third of the American population, a fourth to a third, that believe in something called theistic evolution. And there's even different little subcategories of that. They believe essentially that God guided some sort of evolutionary process. And he did create the universe with wisdom in mind, but somehow he guided a naturalistic evolutionary process to bring us to this point. And that 20% of people who believe in the literal six-day periods are like, well, then how do you explain Adam and Eve? And then there's subgroups that know, well, this is how we explain Adam and Eve, and this is how we live in continuity with the scripture, and you could burn the rest of the afternoon and get even more confused on Google doing a deep dive on this stuff. And here's what I'm here to tell you. In Mercy Road Church, there are people in all three of those categories. You might be sitting next to the category you don't like. But here's what I want to tell you. We just celebrated Easter. Jesus, before he washed the feet that had fecal matter on them of his thick-headed disciples, who would all betray him essentially, before he got down on his knees and washed their feet off, in a radical act of humility, and then willingly went and was tortured to death for them so that he could forgive their sins and ours and restore the world one day fully and finally, he had a few things to say, the majority of which can be summarized in this. Hey guys, disciples, if you want to follow me, love each other, love everybody else like I am about to love you. Love in a feet washing, crucifying type of way. A willingness to give everything for one another. He didn't mention scientific worldview. He didn't mention global warming. He didn't mention how the end times are going to play out in blueprint detail. He just didn't. Another way to say this is everything hangs on what? Fill in the blank. That's really what you skeptical people and you faith-filled people and everyone in between need to answer. What does everything hang on? That's the question. Now, what I'm not saying is that all the little subgroups I mentioned, all those little conversational topics aren't fascinating, interesting, and even really important, and they all have implications, and we are made and endowed with reason to dive deep, debate in love. But all the things I've mentioned to this point, that's not what everything hangs on, not according to the scriptures, not according to Jesus. What does everything hang on? A man named Paul, whose life was radically changed, had this to say. In a letter he wrote to a church that was so wild, they made Las Vegas look tame. They were arguing about all sorts of things. Can I do this? Can I do that? Can I do this? Can I do that? Can I believe this? Can I believe that? He says, slow down. For if there is no resurrection of the dead, then Christ has not been raised either. Someone had suggested maybe the resurrection isn't even real. He said, slow down. There's a bunch of us that saw this happen. If there's no resurrection of the dead, then Christ has not been raised either. And if Christ has not been raised, then all preaching, this preaching, his preaching, your preaching, is what? Useless. And your faith and my faith is what? Useless. He goes on to say, if Christ has not been raised, us Christians who live differently than the rest of the world, who try to follow the example of the Master Jesus Christ, who give sacrificially, even when it hurts, we're to be pitied more than any other people on planet Earth. If this golf ball is just going to burn out one day and no God designed it and no God's going to redeem it and you're not going to live forever and you're going to live like a Christian for the 10 minutes of linear time that you've got to experience sensory perception, you're most to be pitied than all human beings that have ever lived. Because you're called to a life of radical sacrificial love, serving others, fighting against some of the very impulses in your body. I don't know, like, I like that. I'm going to take it. I'm going to steal it. I don't feel like telling the truth. I'm going to lie. You're going to have to fight against some of those things. And so you're most of all to be pitied. But Paul was convinced that resurrection was real. He bet his life. He bet the farm on the idea that God did become a human being. The Son of God, Jesus Christ, lived, walked among us, lived the life that we can't live, the perfect life, that he went to the mat for us. He died in our place. He forgave our sins so that we who are made to last forever can live with him forever in a restored golf ball, a new heavens and a new earth. And if that's true, well, then everything changes. And everything is simplified. And science becomes merely a method to grow deeper in your worship, in your sense of awe, in your sense of surrender. So that's the question. For those of you who are very scientific and analytical, I have some homework for you if you'll accept it. Take that scientific mind and just table some of the hot button debates like evolution and global warming and gender science and all, whatever, fill in your emotionally loaded scientific or pseudoscientific issue here. Table that just for a minute. You can come back to it. And just enter into a season in your life where you say, God, I'm going to use my rationality, every bit of it, and I'm going to do a deep dive on this resurrection thing because it either happened or it didn't, and I set my watch by it because all of human linear history is now dictated and predicated on the death of this guy that claimed to have risen to life and walk around for 40 days and over 500 people saw him. So I want to get to the bottom of that. And I want to make a decision that it happened or it didn't, because if you conclude it didn't happen, we'd still like to hang out with you, but if that's what you've really concluded, you might not like to hang out with us because we're going to be living in a countercultural way that only makes sense in light of revolution. But if you do conclude it does happen, it did happen, wow, that's going to change your life. It's going to change your death too. You'll face it fearlessly. It's going to change how you navigate through adversity. It's going to have implications that will ripple through every bit of your life, and you will need every bit of that scientific, rational, analytical brain to think through those implications so that you can faithfully love and serve other people. Are science and faith mutually exclusive? No. Did God create everything that we see with wisdom? Yes, he did. Did God create you? Does he know you personally? No, you think. How could he know me personally? The scriptures say he knows every star personally. Remember the star conversation? Remember light years? Do you know how many stars there are in the universe that we are in? That's only the one that we know of. Do you know that there are over 1 billion universes that we know of right now? There's a lot more stars than there are people. If he can tend to each one of those and knows them by name, that has a profound implication. He knows you by name. He loves you. He's a plan for your life. Use your scientific mind to run to him, to embrace him. Let's pray. God, thanks for this series. I know it's kind of heavy. And so I just pray that you would minister to everybody here, even those who don't believe in you and who are just maybe even more confused now. Lord, you're not a God who is known by confusion, but you are a God who is very comfortable with mystery. And thank you for that, because it's the mystery that humbles us. And it's when we're on our knees that we're the best students. And when we are the best students, we become wise. And we want to become wise. Help us who have questions, deep, deep reservations. Help us to see the truth, Lord. For those of us who believe we have the truth, who believe in resurrection, who believe that everything does hang on resurrection, would you give us humility and gentleness and a winsomeness as we interact with our brothers and sisters who doubt? Would you show us how to not be divisive, but be loving? Would you show us how to wash our feet and other people's feet in our intellectual debating? Would you show us how to love like you as we welcome skeptics here? Mercy Road, in Jesus' name, amen.